It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Legislative leaders and the governor want paper manufacturer Kimberly-Clark to extend a September 30th deadline for the state Senate to vote on a tax incentive package that could cost up to $100 million. And that plays a role in whether it'll close its Cold Spring manufacturing plant. We check in with WPR News state capitol reporter about the deadline and the future of Kimberly-Clark in Wisconsin. Are you or your family members involved with the Cold Spring plant? What questions or concerns do you have? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio News state capitol reporter. Laurel, thank you for joining us this morning.
Absolutely, John. Thanks for having me.
September 30th has come and gone, and elected leaders wanted Kimberly-Clark to extend its self-imposed decision for a vote by the Senate. What does that mean next, if anything?
Well, it's looking like they haven't extended the deadline. We haven't heard anything from Kimberly-Clark about that. Local officials did ask them to do so last Wednesday, so there was a little bit of notice there if they were going to make that decision. I think we would have heard something. We do know that some local reporters checked in with Governor Walker over the weekend. He was at the Packer game on Sunday. And so WLUK-TV in Green Bay asked the governor, hey, it looks like this deadline is going to pass. What's going to happen? And he told them that there were a lot of ongoing talks last week. Lawmakers and the governor were in touch with Kimberly-Clark, and he said they are, quote, still cautiously optimistic. I think he's talking about lawmakers and himself, not necessarily the company. He says that our hopes will be that early on Monday, we'll be able to get to a point where we can figure out what the next step is. So things seem pretty, flexible.
Well, do we know why Kimberly-Clark set September 30th as the deadline? What was the magic about that date?
That is something that I don't know, and I'm not sure that any other, at least reporters, know. I don't know if that's
somebody knows. But
somebody knows. Presumably Kimberly-Clark knows.
The only thing I can think of is that October 1st is the start of the federal fiscal year, but I don't know why that would have anything to do with Kimberly-Clark, because corporations use a different calendar. Okay, well, right. Skip that question then. It's irrelevant. Let's take a step back, though. When was this $100 million tax incentive package first brought to the legislature for consideration?
First brought up in February. So Kimberly-Clark announced in January that it was going to cut jobs in two Wisconsin facilities, and this was part of a nationwide plan that involved 10 plants. And so the governor quickly proposed this Foxconn-style incentive package, as everyone's calling it, and it passed the state assembly in February, but quickly hit a snag, as things sometimes do, in the other body of the state legislature, the state Senate, and was never voted on there, and hence the sort of limbo that we've had up until now.
So what would this package have done for Kimberly-Clark?
So it would have provided them with, like I said, these Foxconn-style incentives. So it's 15% on any 15% tax credit on any capital expenditures, so any construction projects, things like that, and 17% tax credit on their payroll. And because manufacturers like Kimberly-Clark or Foxconn or others don't currently pay taxes in Wisconsin because of the manufacturing and agriculture tax credit, this money would go to them in the form of basically a check from the state for these amounts. And it would cost about, according to the state's budget office, about $109 million over 15 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Why was the Senate unable to get the votes last spring?
Well, I think the primary argument that I've heard about is that some lawmakers are concerned there are two things. One is that they're concerned with the precedent that this sort of deal would set. They said, you know, we passed Foxconn. It was a once in a lifetime, once in a century opportunity. We don't want to set the precedent of giving these incentive packages, which are quite expensive, to every company that has a problem that is, you know, facing job cuts or is considering moving into or out of the state of Wisconsin. The other concern that folks have is just on principle, these kind of incentive packages. Some lawmakers don't think that government should be involved in, you know, they call it picking winners and losers in terms of business in the state.
Well, I mean, not to sound too cynical here, but once the Foxconn deal was confirmed, did anybody believe that we wouldn't see something like this coming up later on with when Kimberly-Clark, you know, are they just the first and is the line extending out the door?
Well, I think that that's something that we have certainly asked the governor on multiple occasions, really, saying, is every deal going to be a Foxconn deal from here on out? Because we have offered these incentives, what are we going to do when other companies ask for them? Is there going to be an expectation? Is it going to be sort of that line out the door? And he insists that he is not going to offer this unless it's a specific scenario. And he argues that Kimberly-Clark meets that Foxconn threshold because of the impact it has on the state economy. He says that these are high-tech jobs. This isn't a classic paper manufacturer that some people might think of. He said this is a place that makes all kinds of consumer products. They've invested a lot in their facility. So these are good jobs. And there are a number of businesses around Wisconsin that provide products and things. They're part of the supply chain for Kimberly-Clark. And so if that facility closes, they'll be affected as well. So he says he's being discerning about where these packages go, who they're offered to. Mm-hmm. And so it's not going to be everybody in the future, but only people that he thinks are it's necessary to do so.
Laura White is Wisconsin Public Radio News State Capitol Reporter. This is our State Capitol Report. We're getting an update on the situation with Kimberly-Clark. The September 30th deadline passed for the Senate to take action on a $100 million incentive package, and we're talking about that on the State Capitol Report. For those who may have just dropped in from outer space someplace or may have been, I don't know, living in a cave without any access to media, there is an election coming up. Is there any sense of what this Kimberly-Clark situation might mean for people on the campaign trail, both at the statewide level and specifically in the Fox Valley? There are people in the Senate, state Senate and Assembly who are running for re-election there or election. Any sense for what this issue, how this issue will play out on the campaign trail?
Absolutely. I think the biggest person that we've been focusing on in that regard is Senate President Roger Roth. He's the state senator that represents that area where the Kimberly-Clark facility is. And he has pushed very hard for this package. He's been sort of the, you know, other than the governor, the marquee person that's been working on this. And so I think there's certainly a major presence for Kimberly-Clark in his campaign. Mm-hmm. In terms of other lawmakers, the governor has said openly multiple times that he thought this would be easier to accomplish and it would be better to take care of this incentive package after the election. So I think there's an understanding that this is a complicated issue.
Okay. Well, we'll keep our eyes open. We know that you're watching this. We may hear something more this morning. Laura White, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks, John.
Laura White is Wisconsin Public Radio News State Capitol Reporter. And coming up on the hour, we'll be talking about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination and where that is in the Senate. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The United States Senate Judiciary Committee has moved Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the United States Supreme Court forward for consideration by the full body after agreeing to a call for a one-week investigation into sexual assault allegations against the nominee. This morning on The Morning Show, we're going to take a look at the judicial process and what this might mean for the upcoming midterm elections. We'll be talking about this with a political scientist and with you, should you choose to join us. What questions do you have about the process involving the hearings and the investigation surrounding Brett Kavanaugh? What would you like the Senate to do? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa and a faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans. He is the author of Iowa Votes, Registration Demographics, 1982 to 2016, and most recently, Supreme Court Agenda Setting, the Vinson Court. Tim Hagel, welcome to The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
On Saturday, the FBI began its first full day of work on an additional background investigation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. How does this kind of investigation compare to past processes of Supreme Court nominees? Is this unique?
Well, in terms of a background check, that part of it, of course, isn't unique. And in fact, Kavanaugh had gone through one not only for his nomination to the Supreme Court, but as was often mentioned during the hearings, five previous ones for various positions that he'd held, including his current one as a judge on the Court of Appeals. But this particular sort of supplementary investigation is rare, but obviously it's not unique. Again, during the hearings, the Democrats in particular often mentioned how during the Clarence Thomas hearings, when Anita Hill's accusations were made public, that we learned that there had been a supplemental FBI investigation, although at the time it was confidential and we didn't learn about it until a little bit later, but still it was a situation where the background investigation had been reopened for supplemental information to be gathered.
How does the timing of this investigation compare to the Clarence Thomas process?
Well, with the Clarence Thomas process, there were some differences there in terms of, like what happened this time with Dr. Ford. Anita Hill initially made her accusations, and she wanted it to stay confidential. She didn't want her name used. But this was done, although it was done at a time when we didn't know about her accusations or what her claims were against Clarence Thomas. And so this was, again, done out of the public spotlight. And it was only later that we learned of the FBI report and saw what the allegations were and then had that second round of hearings. Here, of course, this time, the allegations were made public very quickly, and then we learned of Dr. Ford's identity shortly thereafter. And so now this is sort of an after-the-fact attempt to try to find more information for the FBI.
How does the tone of this process, of the hearings, compare to the Clarence Thomas hearings?
Well, they're both pretty ugly in terms of what's going on. In terms of the allegations themselves, for those that that recall or old enough to recall, that essentially what Anita Hill was alleging that Clarence Thomas had said things to her, asked her on dates, and talked about pornographic movies and some things along those lines, which many people thought were outrageous even at that time. But, of course, nothing really to the extent of the sexual assault that Dr. Ford is alleging this time. So in terms of the allegations, they're much more serious, I would say. And even particularly in regard to what we're seeing more generally as part of the Me Too movement. So I think that that's part of what's going in and what people's reaction to a lot of this is. And so it's not entirely surprising in a political environment where, of course, Republicans feel that this is like an 11th hour allegation, maybe drummed up on the part of Democrats to stall Kavanaugh nomination. And so you get that political aspect that's going on that can make things get even particularly ugly.
You mentioned Me Too, so let's talk about that for just a moment. This inquiry and nomination process are happening in the Me Too era, if we can call it that. How does that factor into all of this?
Well, one of the things that we've seen, and particularly this was the case with the Weinstein allegations, that when people started coming out, a lot of people started coming out saying, yes, this happened to me, yes, this happened to me, hence the idea of Me Too. And for many years, apparently, it was kept quiet. People were not willing to come forward for a variety of reasons. in terms of indicating what his behavior had been. And then, of course, we saw a number of other people that have made accusations against them. I'm not going to run through the whole list, but, you know, you could recall in the news that a variety of people that were fairly famous were then accused and either lost their jobs or had to sort of go out of it, go out of the public eye. And so then you see a situation where some people maybe were pushing back a little bit. And so one of the famous ones, given what happened on Saturday Night Live this last week, is that apparently Matt Damon had pushed back a little bit and said, well, wait a minute, you know, we need to maybe take these allegations seriously, but it's not an automatic sentence of guilt. You have to look at the particulars of a given situation. Some people then were unhappy with him for having said that and suggested that. So that's kind of where we're at right now, is that situation where you see the Believe Women or Believe Survivors hashtags on Twitter, and that's fine. You want to believe people. But on the other hand, does that mean you throw the process out the window? And there's some famous cases, of course, where people were accused of a variety of sexual improprieties all the way up to and including rape, and that turned out to not be the case. You think of the Rolling Stone and the University of Virginia situation, or a few years ago, the Duke lacrosse team where members were accused of rape and turned out to be false allegation. And there's a political aspect to that, too. And so as a result, you know, people maybe need to step back a little bit, and that's what makes it hard given the political environment where Democrats want to oppose Kavanaugh, Republicans want to support him. And so throw that into the whole mix of what's going on with the specific allegations in Me Too, and it, again, can become very ugly.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. We're talking about the process by which we nominate and confirm candidates to join the Supreme Court of the United States. The Senate Judiciary Committee moved Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the full body, and there's a one-week investigation into the sexual assault allegations which were made against Judge Kavanaugh. We're talking about how that process works with Tim Hagel. And with you, if you care to join us, at 800-642-1234. Specifically, Tim, what will this limited inquiry do, and what is the FBI's role here?
Well, again, basically the FBI is going to try to find some information that relates to the allegations made against Brett Kavanaugh. You know, from the Republicans' point of view, they didn't really see that this was necessary. Most of them, of course, was Senator Jeff Flake, who's a Republican, that basically called for this, along with a couple of other somewhat undecided members, or at least undeclared members of the Senate, Murkowski and Collins in particular, that basically the FBI is going to go out and maybe interview some possible witnesses. Of course, Dr. Ford and her allegations named a couple of other people, and even though those people submitted statements through their attorneys indicating that they had no knowledge of the event that Dr. Ford indicated, that particular party or gathering, that still the FBI could go in and talk to them and say, all right, well, you know, do you remember this? Do you remember that? Did you see this? Did you see that? And so that's what they can do, and perhaps even talk to, and I'm not sure they would necessarily need to, given that Kavanaugh and Ford already testified before Congress, but they may or may not talk to them as well. There's some indication that maybe the FBI would look at some of the other allegations of women that had come forward, Ramirez in particular, who said that Kavanaugh exposed himself to her at a party. I don't know if they're going to go over the sweat necks allegations. Those seem to be pretty outrageous given the numbers of people that were involved. They may not take those seriously, but we'll have to wait and see how it shakes out in the end.
So what does the fact that the FBI is involved in this type of inquiry tell us about Judge Kavanaugh's nomination in particular, and about whether the nomination process in general is changing? Is this something we can look forward to in future nominations, do you think?
I certainly hope not. Basically, the process for nominations changed drastically, and at least as I tell my students, back in the late 80s with the nomination of Robert Bork. And, of course, we've even heard a few times here the term Borking being used, where from, again, the Republican point of view, that the charges that were leveled against the nominee, who was a judge at the time on the D.C. Court of Appeals as well, that they were leveled against him were just not true in terms of his judicial philosophy and what that might mean. They didn't really get into the personal side of things at that point, but it seemed to be an indication that Democrats were willing to go very hard against a number of Republican nominees, particularly in a situation where they believed that it might change the ideological balance on the court. And so that's why, to some extent, you see where we didn't have much opposition to Gorsuch when he came up, because he was replacing Scalia, so a conservative for a conservative really wasn't going to change much. Whereas this time, Democrats and those on the left felt a greater need to oppose Kavanaugh, given that he was going to be replacing, although Kennedy was a conservative, he's kind of a moderate conservative, and he voted mm-hmm. with liberals on a number of important issues, abortion being one of them on occasion. And so the concern was that he would change that ideological balance.
Tim Hagel, stay with us. More to come with this. And when we come back, I'd like you to talk. I'd like your reaction to what Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona suggested and what came to pass in terms of how this investigation got started. I'd like to get your reaction to that. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He stays with us as our guest. You can join us, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of all of this? I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court is on our minds this hour, specifically the process and how this looks going forward. What do you think the United States Senate should do? What do you want them to do? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He is our guest this hour. Tim, this investigation comes, the FBI investigation we referenced earlier, comes after Friday's vote by the Senate Judiciary Committee to move Brett Kavanaugh's nomination forward for a Senate floor vote. However, Republican Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona suggested the delay of the floor vote with a request for a limited FBI inquiry, ultimately setting that as a condition for his support for Brett Kavanaugh on the Senate floor. What was your reaction to Senator Flake's move?
Well, it was a little surprising that I was watching the hearing, of course, and there was this long pause in it where they were supposed to have a vote. Well, they were supposed to have a vote at 9:30 on Friday, and then that got delayed. And they were going to have it at, I think it was 1:30 Eastern time. And there was this long delay, and you could see, and people were talking about how Flake was talking with Coons, and then a bunch of senators went into the anteroom, and there was kind of a lot of back and forth. And so it seemed pretty clear that something was going on. And, you know, it's not entirely surprising that, as people were saying, senators like to talk, they like to make deals. That's kind of what the Senate does. And so apparently Flake, because of being challenged in an elevator by a couple of folks that were arguing with him about the vote and so forth, that kind of convinced him to get together with Coons, who he has sort of a personal relationship with. They've been to Africa together and so forth, to say, look, okay, you guys being the Democrats want an additional week, and that didn't seem to be a big deal according to Flake. And so he basically said, look, I will vote to move this forward to the floor, but to get my support on the floor, I want to see this FBI investigation for a week, a limited in scope, limited in focus. And so some other senators that were, again, sort of in the undeclared or undecided categories, I imagine for Murkowski and Collins for the Republicans and perhaps even Manchin for the Democrats, they said, okay, at least as far as Murkowski and Collins are concerned, they said, yes, we need that too. And, of course, because Republicans only have a very, very thin majority in the Senate, losing two votes would mean that the nomination would fail, so they didn't have much choice but to get the White House to reopen the FBI investigation.
So in this process, this was kind of a rare example of actual bipartisanship, wasn't it?
Yeah, basically it was. And again, you know, it kind of brings to mind a point that a number of people have made, that in the old days when the Senate used to get along much better together, it wasn't quite so divided along party lines, that the senators, regardless of party, would get together, you know, socialize outside of work hours with each other, go to dinner or something like that, or go to, you know, whatever. And this seemed to be an example of that, where both, as I said, Flake and Coons, they had been on an Africa trip together and so forth, and kind of gotten to know each other and understood each other, and apparently they're both very devout. And so that sort of was that sort of key to reaching across the aisle, so to speak. Now, of course, Flake's vote made a lot of Republicans very unhappy, that they didn't see that it was that this additional background check or supplemental background check was going to be of any particular value, given what sort of we knew at the time on Friday when the hearing was made. It's just sort of a way to delay. And to some extent, we've seen that where as soon as the agreement was made, the number of people were saying, oh, well, it can't be limited to a week, it can't be limited to scope, and so on and so forth. So we'll still have to see how it turns out in the end. But you're right that it did seem to be one of those rare instances of some bipartisan working together.
Let's take a phone call. Lisa is with us from Janesville this morning. Lisa, thanks for joining the morning show.
Good morning. I guess I would have to say, as somebody who reported a sexual assault in 1986 and was not believed, and there is the knowledge that between 2 to 10% of allegations are false, I find it, and I think most survivors find it, insulting that it's to not even automatic, an investigation doesn't automatically go forward. I'm not assuming this man's guilt or innocence one way, but at least give that allegation the merit that you go forward. And on that level, I know that the investigation scope has been limited to even the point where the president has said that Mark Judge's the grocery store he worked at cannot be asked questions or records to verify that he worked there. And so this, many, many survivors and people are not going to see this investigation as legitimate if the FBI is not given the free rein that the president originally said he would give them.
What about this, the limitations, Tim Hagel, the limitations on the investigation? Does this concern you at all?
Well, it's certainly a point that has been made by a number of other folks. And as far as the specific allegations in terms of the sexual assault and investigating that, one of the problems, of course, is that that's not really the FBI's job. This really isn't a criminal investigation where the FBI would have the power to issue subpoenas and forcibly interview witnesses. At this point, it's all kind of voluntary. Again, it's basically a background check, and so they'll have a number of people that the FBI will talk to, and so that's sort of the approach they take in this type of situation. And there's been some back and forth as to whether the statute of limitations is run on this particular activity, but apparently the Maryland police, or at least the ones in that particular community where the event occurred, the assault occurred, have said that they're willing to investigate if somebody files a report, and to date nobody has. And so I guess that's part of it, is that you do have to, aside from the problems of people, including sometimes police, not taking these things seriously, so you do have to report them or else nothing's going to be done.
Thank you, Lisa, for your phone call this morning. You could also join us at 800-642-1234. Gloria from Oshkosh called earlier to say she hopes the inquiry isn't just limited to allegations of sexual assault, like the Clinton investigation wasn't just about Monica Lewinsky. It was about whether the president had committed perjury. That's what this should be about, too. Did Judge Kavanaugh commit perjury? Is he fit to be a judge? What do you think about that, Tim?
Well, the thing about the Clinton investigation is that it's kind of a whole different situation, that you had Ken Starr, who was the prosecutor, special prosecutor at the time, I'm not sure that was his title, but whatever it was, that he was basically starting with what was called the Whitewater investigation, some Arkansas land deals, and so it kind of progressed from there. And as part of that particular investigation, you ran into the situation with Monica Lewinsky and the fact that Clinton, you know, perjured himself and so forth. So the parallel there is more the Russia investigation against Donald Trump, because, again, the way the prosecutor goes, that really is a criminal investigation, whereas, again, here what we see is more just the background check. So it's a much more limited just by its very nature, and the FBI doesn't have the powers, as I said, to subpoena people and force witnesses to testify or give them information and so forth that they would have in a criminal investigation. So, again, they're going out and talking to people. But on the other hand, one of the concerns, again, that Republicans had was that this would basically be something unlimited, because their view is that Democrats are just trying to delay the vote, hopefully from after the midterms, when maybe Democrats are going to take control of the Senate and would be able to just vote down the nomination. So, again, that political aspect, it really changes the dynamic in terms of how you can approach this type of situation. But that's sort of the environment in which the allegations were made, and so it is what it is.
Let's take another call. Mary joins us from Milwaukee next. Mary, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning. I'm just wondering, really, when they make a decision that, okay, maybe he's just not the right fit. He's just not the right person. Who makes that decision, and how does that come about?
Mary, thanks for that. Tim Hagel?
Well, basically, there are two ways of looking at that. One is that it's really the president that makes that choice. We've seen in the past situations where the president did pull a nomination or got a nominee to pull the nomination. George W. Bush did this with his nomination of Harriet Myers when there was a lot of pushback where people weren't really sure about her qualifications and her background and so forth. After Robert Bork was voted down, his next nominee from Reagan was a fellow by the name of Douglas Ginsburg, who was another D.C. Court of Appeals judge, and it had been learned that he had smoked marijuana while on the faculty at law school, and so this was something that was an embarrassment to the president, so his nomination was pulled fairly quickly. So the president is ultimately the one that can do that, but of course the Senate has that power too in terms of just having a vote and saying, no, we reject this person, as they did for Robert Bork. Or, of course, you can point to what the Republican-controlled Senate did with Merrick Garland, where they said because of the politics of the situation, election year, and so forth, that we won't even have a committee hearing on this fellow.
Mary, thank you for your call this morning. The part of the discussion after the hearings was not just around the sexual assault allegations that were made by Dr. Ford, but also the way that Judge Kavanaugh responded when it was his turn to testify, and the anger and what some call the almost like political threats, like to Democrats, you know, you're going to pay for this sort of thing, that in itself would call into question the qualification of Judge Kavanaugh to serve on the Supreme Court. Compare the way Judge Kavanaugh responded to, for example, the way previous Supreme Court nominees had testified to Congress.
Well, that really, except for maybe one example, it's not necessarily a fair comparison to other nominees, because other nominees didn't have these kinds of accusations made against them except for Clarence Thomas. And Clarence Thomas came back very strong as well in his response to what was going on. And Brett Kavanaugh did that too. And to a certain extent, at least in terms of his opening statement, that was probably a good thing for him, that it showed that his position, of course, is that this didn't happen. He didn't do it. He doesn't know anything about this, and he's being asked to address these charges. And for the most part, an innocent person would react this way. And it's kind of a funny thing, because sometimes we see people react, you know, they're calm. Sometimes they act that they're very emotional. And often, regardless of which way they react, people are going to say, oh, well, he should have acted the other way, kind of thing. And I know Democrats have suggested, well, this was a job interview, so you needed to show that judicial temperament. Well, he did during his first hearing, but not necessarily second, given the circumstances.
We have to take a break. Stay with us, Tim Hagel. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about the process we use to nominate and confirm justices to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Brett Kavanaugh nomination is on the floor of the Senate this week, with additional FBI background checking in process. Do you think this controversy will have an effect on the Supreme Court? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest, Tim Hagel, an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, beyond the investigation, what's the next step for this judicial process? What does it mean now that it's on the floor of the Senate? How is this going to work out?
Well, of course, to a certain extent, or maybe even to a large extent, we have to wait and see what the FBI report actually shows. In fact, I was just sort of catching up on Twitter during the break, and it was pointed out that the supplemental investigation by the FBI is supposed to remain confidential, as is the general background information. but it's given to the White House and then it's passed along to the Senate. But we can probably be assured that at some point along the way it's going to leak. And I have to imagine that given the circumstances here, given that the supplemental investigation was done at the behest of the Senate after the hearings, that it probably would be less confidential than would ordinarily be the case, meaning that the public would find out about this. And, of course, we may have some additional arguments on the part of senators regarding this. But in terms of the procedure, that basically the procedure has begun where there's a certain time period along the way and the period for debate of up to 30 hours for people. So even once we get that report, it's going to be several days before we're able to or before the Senate is able to move forward with a particular vote. So most people are expecting that probably wouldn't happen at least until the end of this week, probably into next week in terms of the Senate's business.
So put on your political science professor hat very firmly here and describe for us the Senate's role, the way it's supposed to work out in the confirmation process. What's its job?
Well, the Constitution says advise and consent, and so that's kind of an open question. Like many phrases in the Constitution, it can be open to interpretation. And for a lot of years, basically the idea was is that as long as whoever the president nominated was qualified in terms of academic and legal ability and judicial temperament, whatever that means, that they would pass that person along, even if it was the Senate was controlled by somebody from the opposite party. And that's why you see in some instances, some very lopsided votes of 99 to nothing or 98 to 1 or something like that, where people would be passed along, including justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Breyer and so forth that are currently on the court. But now it's become much more political, and we see where the notion of judicial temperament, and this was something that Democrats had often talked about, where somebody like Bork, for instance, which I'd mentioned earlier, was considered to be out of the judicial mainstream, was the phrase that was used. Well, clearly Bork's legal qualifications were very, very good, but people just didn't like him ideologically. So the ideological component became much more a part of this and has been progressively so since, the late 80s. And that's probably not going to change as long as the court is so evenly divided, so to speak, kind of a 5 conservatives, 4 liberals at this point, with maybe one of those conservatives swing justices. Now it looks like Roberts is going to be that middle justice. Plus, of course, if you've got a situation where the Senate is very closely divided, and plus whatever's going on in the general political environment, that the sort of the politics of it are going to take predominance or be predominant at least for a while.
So do you have the impression that we've kind of entered, there's probably no doubt that we've entered this, but I'd like you to comment on what appears to be a sort of a scorched earth brand of politics, where it's sort of a winner-take-all situation, and other than this conversation that Flake and Coons had in the Senate, we've taken bipartisanship and just kind of thrown it out the window. What does that mean going forward for anybody who a president might nominate to the Supreme Court?
Well, it means it could be a very difficult nomination process. Now, again, I think that part of it, what makes this particular nomination more intense than, say, the last one with Gorsuch replacing Scalia, has to do with the fact that it was seen that Kavanaugh would shift that ideological balance, because Kennedy being more of a swing vote, they didn't see Kavanaugh in that role, so it would shift the balance to the right a little bit. Well, the balance on the Supreme Court shifts from the left to the middle to the right and back and forth. It just kind of depends over time how that goes. But, of course, people that are very concerned about certain issues that maybe are hanging by a thread, so to speak, that maybe one vote would make a difference, that obviously this is very important to them. But you're right that it does sort of plant that idea that maybe we're going to have this, as you say, a scorched earth kind of approach to it, and that's particularly going to be the case if Republicans look at this and say, well, look, if this is the way you guys want to do this, then we're going to do the same thing to your nominee. Maybe that'll happen, maybe not. It didn't happen, as I said, after the Bork nomination. Republicans didn't sort of take that approach with justices like Ginsburg and Breyer. Of course, as I saw somebody respond to an argument along those lines saying, well, yeah, but so-and-so didn't commit these kinds of things. Well, that may be true. We don't know. but most people have something that's embarrassing in their background. I remember when I was interviewed once for a committee that serves people that are presidential appointed to serve on this committee. I was asked by someone kind of a low-level background check saying, well, is there anything in your background that would be embarrassing to the president? That's kind of the front page of the Washington Post test. So if it got on the front page of the Washington Post, it would embarrass the president. Well, geez, we've all got those kinds of things in the background, that you did this or you did that dumb thing as a kid, or especially if it's, you know, you're in high school. So are you going to be willing to dig those things up? Does that really matter? Well, we'll see. Hopefully it won't be the case going forward, but you can sort of understand where it might get worse before it gets better.
How do you think this whole situation with the Kavanaugh nomination and the investigation and all of that, what does this mean for the midterm elections? How is this going to play out?
Well, that's a good question, because it does seem that this has gotten both sides more enthused and energized. Now, Democrats have been pretty energized anyway over the Kavanaugh nomination. They just, again, didn't particularly like him and thought he was going to change votes and change precedent in some important cases. But what it's also seemingly done has gotten the right energized, that there was some concern that maybe a number of people on the right that were still maybe a little unhappy with President Trump's methods, his demeanor, things of that nature, that they may have decided to not vote in midterms, because, of course, there's always a lower turnout in midterms than in presidential years. And both parties are trying to combat that. They know, look, this is really important. You have to get out there and vote, that the House is in play, the Senate may be in play, control of those bodies. And so this seems to have energized the right. The problem, of course, is that those folks tend to vote at a much higher turnout than the middle people, the independents. In Iowa, we call them no-party voters. And those are the folks that you have to get out to the polls and hopefully vote for your party, whatever party that happens to be. And so we're just going to have to wait and see, with about 5 weeks or so left, to what's going to happen here.
So what are you watching for now in the Senate as this proceeds? What are some of the things that are going to, say, tip you off as to which way this whole thing's going to go?
Well, pretty much all the votes are pretty sure. Again, it depends on the specifics of the FBI investigation. But as long as Flake and Murkowski and Collins are satisfied, then Republicans will have the votes to be able to pass the nomination on a very slim majority. The Republicans could lose one of those votes, and then it would be a 50-50 tie, and Vice President Pence would cast the deciding vote, which would then be the closest vote ever for a Supreme Court nominee. But as long as they're satisfied that the FBI investigation didn't reveal anything more damaging to Brett Kavanaugh in terms of maybe finding some corroborating evidence or something of that nature, and as long as those three senators vote with the majority, then you might also see a couple of the Democrats, Joe Manchin, West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp, North Dakota, join them, because they're in tough races themselves.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be obviously keeping an eye on this as well, and probably having further conversations about this as we go along here. Tim Hagel, thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's also faculty advisor to the University of Iowa College Republicans, and he's also the author of Iowa Votes, Registration Demographics 1982 to 2016, and more recently, Supreme Court Agenda Setting, the Vincent Court. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.